I want to finally finish up this trilogy of reasons before we go on to other less comprehensive reasons that were given, causes that were given for the Holocaust. We've mentioned three that really go together. We've explained two of them, and now's the time for the third one. And I hope we'll finish it tonight. At most, we'll finish at the beginning of next year. And then we'll go back to our regular schedule of doing part halacha and part this. But this, I just want to finish up this. Doesn't drag on to whatever. We said that one cause that many Gedolei Yisrael cited as a source for tragedies and therefore something to be misorer from the Holocaust was assimilation. Germany especially, German assimilation, reform, Haskalah, and we explained that over a few weeks. And then we said that others attributed it to the rise of secular Zionism, which is also, as we explained last time, the last two times, a form of national assimilation. So it's just another facet of that first reason. Secular Zionism was nothing more than another attempt of secularizing the Jewish people and assimilating them amongst the nations, not total assimilation to lose their identity completely, but to lose their identity as Torah Jews. That we finished. We have one more thing to do, which we said on the outset seems to be contradictory to all of this, and the rich truth is that it's really another facet of the same thing. And that is the cause. Here, the most famous one who mentioned this is Rav Teichtel in Eim HaBonim Smecha, that the fact that there was an ability in the end of the 1800s, the beginning of the 1900s, there was a window of opportunity to make Aliyah to Eretz Israel, and for the most part, Frum HaYidden didn't go. Now, first of all, that has to be examined factually, if that's true or not. Did Frum HaYidden go? Did they not go? The truth is, like we spoke about in the history of Zionism, prior to the creation of the secular Zionist movement, the people who were here were Frum HaYidden. The Yishuv was basically Frum. The people who preceded the Yishuv or accompanied the Yishuv here of Aliyah in the 1860s, 70s, 50s was the Chovevei Tzion, which were basically Frum people. So there were Frum people, and the Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov and the Gra, who started this new Yishuv, were also obviously Frum people. So it's not that Bechlal, the first ones here were the secularists and the Frum people didn't come. It's not true. And there's another factor, and that is once the secular Zionists became the spokesman for Aliyah because of the interference or the English, right, who after World War I, like we mentioned, got the mandate on Palestine, they were not interested in Frum people coming here. You can't accuse Frum people of not coming and you be the cause of why they didn't come. Because early on, like we said, the English limited very much the immigration to Eretz Israel by Jews. They didn't want to upset the demography with the Arabs. And they only gave out a certain amount of certificates, a certain quota of people who could come, and they gave it into the hands of the leaders of the Zionist movement to give out those certificates. And they didn't want Frum Yidden here. They had enough trouble with the Frum Yidden who were here. They were hoping that the Frum community that existed here would die out within a generation or two. And that's what Ben-Gurion had said and held, that the Frum Yidden, they would make sure that the education in this country was geared to that the youth would not be Frum, and the old people eventually would die out, and there would not be any more, a negligible amount of Frum people. So they shouldn't want more Frum people coming here. So they curtailed anyone Frum coming, and the certificates that were given to the Mizrahi were used basically for what we call today Dati Lumi people, and the Haredi people were not given too many certificates altogether. So whether they even had the ability to come here is a question. But in any case, the interest also wasn't there for many reasons. One reason was because around the turn of the century, the secular Zionists were the ones who were most involved here, and they were pushing to create a secular society. There was, like we said last week, a cultural war going on, and many rabbonim in Europe advised their balabatim, who wanted to come to Israel, not to come, because they were afraid that the atmosphere and environment was a very negative one, and many people would not be able to put up with the pressures. Pressures being that you couldn't get a job unless you joined the Socialist Party and or the Secular Zionist Movement. And this is what happened to the Taimanim who came here, and to the Moroccans who came here, and after the war to Yaldei Tehran, to survivors, children, orphans of the Holocaust, were put into an irreligious kibbutzim and forced to basically not be Frum. They cut off their payas, they made them eat on Yom Kippur. There's horror stories of what happened. So from the time that the secular Zionists became very much the dominant moving force in Eretz Yisrael, it was a very negative environment for Frum people. So Enochan Ami, Rabbanim said it's better to remain Frum in Europe than to go to Eretz Yisrael and put your whole spiritual life in danger. And even though they also point the finger and say that if more Rabbanim had said they should go to Eretz Yisrael, then maybe these people wouldn't have been lost in the Holocaust. But like we said, that may be true. But in the final analysis, somebody who is killed in this world but dies Frum doesn't lose his Olam Hab. So he lost a few years in this world. Somebody who eventually loses his Yiddishkeit loses a lot more than a few years in this world. So I don't know, in the final analysis, looking back, what was better for these people, to die in the Holocaust or to come and die a spiritual death in Eretz Yisrael, if that was the two options, which is not black and white, but definitely is a consideration. But in any case, with all of that said, right, had there been a mass movement amongst Frum Yidden to come and to counteract the secular Zionists, to make their own movements and emphasize more coming to Eretz Yisrael, then maybe type of things would have different. Maybe the country would have developed differently, just like today. To be more Frum Yidden here, maybe the country would look different. So I want to speak about this idea. It seems to be diametrically opposed to what we spoke about till now. If secular Zionism was a cause for the Holocaust, then how could not coming to Eretz Israel be a cause? So we already explained half of the problem. Secular Zionism has nothing to do with making Aliyah to Eretz Israel, just incidentally. But it's a totally different idea. And now we'll see what Eretz Israel is all about, that it's possible to be an assimilationist and to be Frum. It's not only people who marry out of Yiddishkeit or are secularists that are assimilated. It's possible to be assimilated and to be Frum too. That's what we're going to speak about tonight. And I know that I've spoken about this numerous times even on the Moshav, not only off the Moshav, but there's always new faces here, and the majority of people here, including the Yeshiva Bachrim, have not heard this, at least in this forum, the way that it's going to be presented. And the ones that did, who probably could say this over in their sleep better than I can, so just mouth the words with me. Okay, like we said when we spoke about assimilation in general, the tachlis of Klal Yisrael is to be a mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh. We are supposed to be representatives of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this world. And the way we represent him is by living a life that's holy. To be an example to the nations of the world. We mentioned also that the nations of the world have to be moral. And if they're moral, they'll get a chelek in Olam Haba. We have to be moral plus. Not only do we have to be moral, we have to be more than moral. We have to be holy. The difference between morality and holiness, we'll give some examples as we go on. I'll give an example now that I like to give. Has to do with the Moshav, with the... I don't know even if I ever said it here before. Maybe I did. Okay, in any case, those who are veterans here, remember my Uncle Phil, Zecher Zichrono Livracha. And he used to come and spend between Pesach and Shavuos with us every year. When before my parents made Aliyah, they brought him along too. And if you'll remember, I used to have a study that was the is now the Nauman's house. Okay. And in that house, there were two bedrooms. There were, two bedrooms. And the house was basically filled with sparring. And my teenage daughters, I won't mention the names of them now, but two of my daughters, when they became teenagers, did not like the setup in our house, where we had six boys in one room and five girls in another room. And they considered that oppressive, to have to sleep together with their little sisters, since they were fully mature teenagers. So they petitioned me that I give them the two bedrooms in the study to be their private rooms. They're right across, not terrible, they're teenagers, so we let them sleep in the study, and they had their own rooms, each of them. And however, when my uncle came, so I told them they have to move out, it's Ichud. They can't be alone in the study, even if they've moved into one room together, they can't be in the study alone with my uncle. My uncle at the time was in his late 70s, probably, and he was an old, sickly man who had been all of my children's babysitter and my babysitter also when I was a kid. So they said, look, we'll move into one room, and he can stay in the other room, and Shalom al Yisrael. I told them, not possible, because that's Yichud. You can't have two women and one man, especially at night, in the same building, even if the door's unlocked. And since they have to both use the same bathroom, and there's a common hallway, even if they lock their door, it's not going to help, because inevitably they're going to have to get out of that room. It's not self-contained. And there's no separate entrance. Right? We'd have a back entrance to the room. So they said, Tati, this is ridiculous. What in the world could possibly happen? If you're afraid that we're going to do something, we promise you, no way in the world that we are interested in Uncle Phil. And if you're afraid of Uncle Phil, och and vey. So what in the world could possibly happen? So I gave him a few different answers. The one that's nogea to tonight was the following. I told him, you're right. Morality-wise, if we only had to be moral, there's nothing immoral about the two of you staying in one room and him staying in another room and locking the door, whatever, and perfectly moral. But it's not kodesh. Something that even a far chashash of something that's not proper, that's not okay for a yid. A yid has to be, for a goy to be perfectly okay. What could possibly be immoral about that? But by us, we have to be more than not immoral, we have to be kodesh. And kedusha is where there is no hint of anything that's not proper. That's kedusha. That's what a yid has to be. Unfortunately, some of us are still working on the morality. But that's not, the Nevi'im also spoke to Klal Yisrael about murder and robbery and a host of other things. Because they told us that if you want to be Kodesh, first you have to be moral. So if you're not moral, you can never be Kodesh. So first let's start with morality, then we'll worry about your being Kedosha. But that's the goal. The goal is that Klal Yisrael as a nation has to be an Am Kodesh. And each individual has to be a person who's Kodesh in his life. And it's not an easy thing, and it's a lifetime thing. And some people are successful, and some people aren't successful, and most of us are partially successful. Right? And a few people are extremely successful. Those are the tzaddikim of the door. But most of us have some areas where we're successful, some areas we're not successful, but we try. That's the goal of the Torah, that we should live a life of Kedusha in every aspect of life. In order to do that, we said that there has to be a separation, a insulation between Goyim and Yidden. Since the Goyish world has a different standard, even the best of them have a different standard than we do, a different lifestyle than we are supposed to have. In order that we don't reach the lowest common denominator, we have to be able to be insulated from their lifestyle to create ours. A part of the ability to be insulated is called Eretz Yisrael. When we live amongst the nations of the world, that's not the norm. That's an aberration. The Maharal says, it's abnormal. The Yidden were not supposed to live amongst the nations because then it's very hard to be insulated. It's almost impossible. The ideal was for us to live in our own land, in a land that's conducive for the lifestyle that we're supposed to create. And that's Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael, the antithesis of secular Zionism. Secular Zionism is we want a place, which happened to be incidentally Eretz Yisrael, so we could become a normal nation amongst nations. And the real purpose of Eretz Yisrael is we should have a place where we can become a nation that's different than every other nation, where we can create our own kind of society in every area. Every area. Our married life, our social life, our economic life, our political life, everything should be on a level of Kedusha, on a national level, where the world sees a nation like this, that every aspect of life, every facet of life is holy, and they are impressed with godliness. They don't have to be like that, but it impresses them at least to be moral, at least to be people who recognize there's a God. That's the ultimate goal. And the truth is, here in the state of Israel, right, it's accomplishing that at least in one aspect, political life. Because when the nations of the world hear about Israeli politics, what do they say? Oh my God. So we do remind people of God's existence by our political existence here. But I don't think it's exactly what HaKadosh Baruch Hu had in mind. But in any case, that's the goal. That's the goal. And that means that in every aspect of life, a person has to live different than even the best of the nations of the world. That's why it's possible for a person to keep all Taryag mitzvahs, but to a certain degree miss the point. And his lifestyle, his standards, his values, even though his actions may be one way, but his standards, values, and lifestyle is not changed. That's why Yaakov Avinu said to Esav, "Im lov angarti, v'taryag mitzvah shamarti, v'lo lamadati mimaisav haroi." Yaakov told Esav, "I lived with Lavan for 22 years, and I kept all taryag mitzvahs, and I didn't learn from his evil ways." Now that seems redundant. If he already said he kept all taryag mitzvahs, then why do you have to add, "I didn't learn from his evil ways"? It's obvious. If you kept all Taryag mitzvahs, you obviously didn't learn from Lavan's evil ways. There's many answers to that, many explanations. There's another question. Yaakov didn't keep all Taryag mitzvahs. First of all, he married two sisters. Second of all, there were mitzvahs that couldn't possibly be done because he wasn't in Eretz Yisrael. And those mitzvahs apply only in Eretz Yisrael. So out of the Taryag, you're missing a considerable amount if you're in Chutz Lartz. Right? He also had other mitzvahs that he couldn't possibly do. There's no Beis HaMikdash. So how do you say, Tarik mitzvah shamarti? So it's always medayik in the Rashi. It doesn't say Tarik mitzvah kiyamti. I fulfilled Tarik mitzvahs. Tarik mitzvah shamarti. What does that mean, shamarti? I guarded them. What it means is the following. What Yaakov said is, it would be possible to keep all Tarik mitzvahs and still not be able to say Lelamadati Mimayshav Haroyim. I could have had the same lifestyle, standards, values as Lavan, and just done it kosher. And I like to call that glatt kosher goyishkeit. It's glatt kosher, but it's not Jewish. I'll give you the examples I usually give. I haven't thought of any new ones, so bring out the point. Both of them happened to me in Miami. I don't have any examples from here. But in Miami, when I first came to the Kehila in Miami, my Kehila did not have a mikveh, except one that you could drive to. So Shabbos and Yom Tov, there was no mikveh in the community. It was a small, developing community. They didn't have the money to build a mikveh. The closest mikveh was in Miami Beach, half an hour drive away. We didn't have a yeshiva in our community, not even a high school, Beis Medrash, and at that time, not even a day school, nothing. And the nearest yeshiva was on Miami Beach also. This was like a satellite community that was just developing. And one day, an influential balabas, who was also wealthy, came to me very upset. And he said, Rabbi, something's on my mind. I got to get it off my chest. I got to speak to you. So I asked him what the problem was. So he said, there's something that's been bothering him for a long time. There's one thing that our community is missing, that if we would just have it, we would be a top-notch Torah community. So I got really excited, because I figured he's talking either about a mikveh or about a yeshiva. And as soon as I would find out which one really bothers him, I would tell him, you know what, if it really bothers you that there's no mikveh in this community, or there's no yeshiva, you're a wealthy man, you're influential. I'm making you the chairman of the mikveh committee, chairman of the yeshiva committee. Build one. Don't be upset. Do something. And you're capable of doing it, so do it. So with bated breath, I said to him, what is that one thing that this community is missing that bothers you so much, right, that you had to get it off your chest? He said, a first-rate, glatt kosher French restaurant. After I gained consciousness, trying to figure out where we're putting the mikveh in this restaurant, it hit me, what's the problem here? The problem is not having a glatt kosher French restaurant. If somebody would want to come here to Matityo and open a glatt kosher French restaurant, right, for all of the gourmet people here that would frequent it, and thinks that he could make, you know, a nice business and the Moshav would make rent on it, I have no problem with that. Right? I would let the guy, my expertise in French cuisine ends with French fries, but I'm sure there's something more to it. So I assume that, that there's nothing wrong with that. That's not the problem. The problem is, what does that have to do with being a top-notch Torah community? I understand the guy would tell me, you want to be a top-notch French community. Want to be a top-notch eating community. But what does that do with Torah? I must have missed that shear in tells that they spoke about French restaurants. I never heard of Gifter speak about a French restaurant in my life, that was on the curriculum, right? That when you go into Rabbanus, you should know how to make a French restaurant. What does that do with Torah? Now, what's the idea? People have the same standards and values of the secular world. And they try to make them kosher. So, yeah, it has to be glatt kosher. But just like in the secular world, what makes a community? How many eating establishments? How many cultural establishments? That is the standard of what is a community. So we have to have the same standards, except ours have to be kosher. So that's glatt kosher Goyishkeit. That's not glatt kosher Yiddishkeit. Another example. I used to have a lot of elderly people come to me right after Purim with ads from the Jewish press about cruises to the Bahamas for Pesach. And they would bring me the ad, and they would say, Rabbi, could you check this out? kashrus wise, Shabbos Yontif, Tznius, is it okay? Right? Do you recommend that I go on this cruise, or are there problems? Mostly kashrus problems. So I saw these things advertised, you know, they have shuffleboard and what's it called, the luxury cabins, and they also have tusdarim aboard, what's it called, for Pesach, and glatt kosher, and non-gebrochts, or whatever. But Lemaisa, after looking through the four halakim of Shulchan Aruch, I couldn't find anything wrong, per se, with the cruise. Right? Or a Chaim wise, there was a Minyan, there was a Sefer Torah even aboard, there was a Yoredeya Kashrus wise, it was okay, Eben Ezer is basically was Tznius was okay, there was no major problems, Choshen Mishpat, there was nobody was stealing or misrepresenting, there was nothing from the four Kalakim Shulchan Aruch to find wrong with it. Was anything right with it? Is that what the Rebbe Shlom intended when he gave us Zman Cheruseinu? Should we have a boat going to the Bahamas? Bahamas sounds so much like Bahamas. It's, and again, there's nothing wrong with a cruise. You want to go on a cruise, the Zunterheit. If you need the fresh air, you need the vacation, you need the relaxation. But these people had more fresh air, relaxation in their backyards in Miami than they had on the deck of a cruise ship where they also had seasickness. Right? They could have the same thing if they went in a lounge chair in their backyards, Elamai. It was like the thing to do, right? Because in the Goyish world, that showed that you made it. You went on a cruise to the Bahamas, right? So you already had a social status. So they wanted the same thing, the same standards, the same values, but it had to be glatt kosher. So that's Tarig Mitzvah Shamarti, right? I could keep Tarig Mitzvahs, but you can't say, Lolamarati, Mimaisav HaRoyim. Same standards, the same values. That's not what a Jew is supposed to be. Our standards, our values are supposed to be different. We're supposed to have different goals and different values and not the same thing, just kosher. Just not enough, just not to be over an issue. That's basically what Kedoshim Tiyu is. That's Christ will have to have a lifestyle of Kedusha. And that's what Yaakov meant. I didn't observe all Tarid Mitzvah, it's impossible. But Shamarti means I kept my lifestyle. One, that was conducive later to keeping any mitzvah that came along. Because the mitzvahs did not contradict my lifestyle, my values, my standards, my goals. Right? I didn't have a secular lifestyle and try to do it kosher. That wasn't the case. Tarig mitzvah shamarti, and therefore lo lamadati mimaisav haroyim. And this idea is inherent to Eretz Yisrael. You know, the first Rashi in Chumash says that really the Torah should have started from HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, which is the first mitzvah. The Torah is a book of mitzvahs. Why did it start with Bereishis? So Rashi says, Koach Maisav Higid Li'amo Losesh Lahem Nachlis Goyim. The reason it started with Bereishis is that we should know that we have a claim to Eretz Yisrael. That in case, theoretically speaking, the Goyim come and say that we stole their land, and it's not ours, and we have no rights to it, right? Theoretically speaking, they would ever do that. So we have an answer. The answer is, Bereishis Bara Elokim HaShemayim V'Haaretz, God created the world, He gave it to you temporarily, He took it away from you, gave it to us, it's our land. So we know we have a claim to the land. Very difficult, Rashi. First of all, is it going to help? Right, Goyim are going to come, they're going to claim we stole their land, we conquered their land, it belonged to seven nations, we conquered them. And what are we going to say? Oh, wait, says Bereishis Bara Elokim HaShemayim V'Haaretz. Imagine the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations tomorrow gets up and he says, you know, we've been debating whose land this is, back and forth with accusations or whatever. I forgot to say something. Bereishis Bara Elokim HaShemayim V'Haaretz. It says right here, God created the world. He said He gave us Eretz Yisrael, took it away from you. End of debate. And all the Arabs would say, oh, why don't you say that before? We didn't know. What's it called? If you would have said that before, we would never have given you any trouble. Now we know, Bereishis Bara Elokim. And obviously, right, it would be very anes galui if it helped. Okay? Kind of feel, it'd be nice if he tried it. You know, during the Six-Day War, Rav Shiva told me, after the Six-Day War, there were, I talk about this too, to seminary girls, And in my mind, Six-Day War, I was already in Yeshiva Gedola. I was already 18 during the Six-Day War. And to me, it was like current events. So I talked to these girls as if, like, you know, you remember the Six-Day War, remember what happened before. They were even born in 1967. They weren't born until 20 years later. So here, though, Baruch Hashem, right, to some of you at least, I can talk about it as if it was current events. Remember what happened then. I mean, remember what's it called, the before the war, what kind of sakana. Okay, you don't have to admit that you were there, whatever. My kids think that I was around by the Civil War. Even worse than that. Somebody once asked me in the Israel Center, did you learn in Telz in Lithuania? And just recently, somebody, my son Mati, told somebody who he was. He said, are you related to Rabbi Leth? He said, yes. He says, is that your grandfather? Okay, but here I feel more comfortable that there are those that may not admit it, but you were around the same time as the Six-Day War. The Six-Day War beforehand was a real terrifying situation. I mean, the Nasser was threatening to throw every Jew in the sea openly, and nobody was doing anything. And it appeared like if there would be a war, that was it. That was the end of the Yishuv here. And my Rosh Hashiva said, had they destroyed the Yishuv here, the next day they would have been shechting Jews in Times Square. He said, no shy. So that would have been an open hunting season on Jews by anti-Semites. It's a nice galui that what happened during the Six-Day War. And Klai Yisrael has to be thankful that would have been caused a destruction, not just here in Eretz Yisrael. That would have been enough, too. In any case, after the war...
Should there be another Purim?
What?
Should there be another Purim?
If we had an Anshei Knesset Hagdola, maybe they would have been the Sakana Purim. Maybe not. That's a different discussion. Right? My Rosh Hashiva spoke after the Six-Day War. Is there a place to make a Yom Kippur? Definitely, there's what to be molded to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and Nisim happen, but not every time Nisim happens, and you have to be molded to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to make a Yom Kippur. And he showed that it doesn't have the criteria for making a Yom Kippur, and therefore there's no such thing as a Yom Kippur of Yom Yerushalayim. But that Yidden should be thankful and recognize that Nisim happened, yeah, that he said yes. In any case, so after the war, there were debate upon debate that were televised worldwide of what was going to happen, what kind of ceasefire there was going to be, what kind of peace there was going to be, because the Arabs were like devastated. So they had the proceedings of the United Nations televised, all over the world. And Rav Gifter was upset of the fact that all the Arab ambassadors to the United Nations centered what they had to say about Allah this and Allah that and Allah mol, everything, Allah, Allah, Allah. And Abba Ibn, who was the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, right, who spoke a perfect King's English, he didn't mention God's name once. Right? They're talking about Allah gave us this land and the Jews now took it away and they're aggressors and they started this war. Right, everybody forgot about Nasser threatening to throw us into the sea and him making an embargo on the Suez Canal. That already was forgotten very quickly. But this is our land and God, and the Israeli ambassador doesn't mention God's name at all. So Gifter wrote him a letter. And he said to Abba Ibn, you have an opportunity now to make a tremendous Kiddush Hashem. The whole spotlight is on the United Nations and what you have to say. Why can't you say that we also have a claim to this land because God gave us the land and it says so in the Torah and make a Kiddush Hashem? Let the world know we also have a God, not just the Arabs. You know, a very respectful and a chizuk letter. So we got back an answer on official Israeli, State of Israel stationery. It is the official policy of the State of Israel not to mention God's names publicly. I guess they're afraid of, you know, Shem Shemayim Levatol or whatever. So that's the official position of the State of Israel, right? We hear what you're saying, but our official policy is not to mention God's name publicly. Right? We don't want to mix politics and religion, and therefore it's a nice suggestion, but not lemaisa. So lemaisa, though, it wouldn't help if the United, you know, the ambassador of the United Nations got up and said, Bereshis Bar Elohim, it may be a Kiddush Hashem, but I don't think that the other nations would pay attention. In addition, it happened once that the nations of the world came, the Canaanim came, and brought us to a court case in front of Alexander the Great. He had a world court. And they claimed we stole their land. So they sent somebody called Gvia ben Psisa to argue with them. Now you would think this is it. Bereshis has been waiting for that moment. And Gvia ben Psisa would have said, Bereshis bar Elohim. He didn't. He said, you're right. The land belongs to you. But if you look in the Torah, it says that you belong to us. Because it says, Canaan is Eved Avadim Yeliecha. So you own Eretz Israel, but we own you. And whatever a slave owns belongs to his master. And you haven't served us for quite a while, so we'd like some back pay. So they ran away. But he should have said, Bereshis bar Elohim. It's been waiting for that time. In addition, why did that have to be in the beginning of the Torah? We didn't conquer Eretz Yisrael until 14 years after we came there. And the Torah was given in the beginning of the 40 years. Why couldn't it just be a footnote at the end of the Torah? Right? And by the way, Bereshis bar Elohim. Why does that have to be in the beginning of the Torah? Matam posach b'Bereshis. Why did it start? And lastly, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu give us Eretz Yisrael in such a suspicious way? Wouldn't it have been better if he gave it to us in a way that doesn't beg the question? Why do you have to give us a land that he first gave to seven nations, told us to conquer them, kill men, women, and children? We look like a bunch of murderers and a bunch of conquerors, and now we have a question. Lachari, you're murderers and conquerors. No, Bereshis bar Elohim. Give us Eretz Yisrael in a normal way, in a natural way, without having to conquer it. I can think of natural ways it could happen without any miracles. Right? Klal Yisrael come into Eretz Yisrael, God makes a plague here before we come in. And everybody dies of some kind of plague. Right? And we come in, there's all these dead bodies around, and we do a big mitzvah and bury them for free, and we take over the land and nobody's here. It could have happened. Right? There have been plagues, you know, bubonic plagues that killed millions of people. So all God had to do was, you know, send some little germ and that's the end of the garden. Or even more natural. God could have made the economic situation in Eretz Yisrael so bad that all of the Canaanim would have left and go drive cabs in New York. And the place would have emptied out. And there'd be nobody here. We come and take it over a ghost town. Why did he have to give it to them and then command us to slaughter them? Mamish. Men, women, and children. And then have to have Bereshis to tell us that's okay. The answer, I think, is, at least an answer, is the following. That if you don't understand that you have to create a society that is Kodesh, that has your own standards, your own values, then Eretz Yisrael is meaningless. There's no purpose for it. So if you want to have a claimed Eretz Yisrael, you want to be able to do mitzvahs. Mitzvahs are impossible if you don't have the right standards. You can keep them. But it's not the same. Every mitzvah is a problem. Every mitzvah conflicts with your lifestyle, with your values, with your standards, with your goals. So, therefore, the Torah said, right away in the beginning, before the first mitzvah, it's a preface to the Torah, you're going to have to set your standards, values, according to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not according to the nations of the world. Because if you set your standards and values according to the nations of the world, then you're not going to be able to keep the Torah b'chlal, because everything's going to be a conflict. I'll give you two examples in a second of what that means. I won't. I'll give you two examples next week of what that means. But, and if you do that, and you do set your standards and values not on God, but on the nations of the world, then you don't need Eretz Yisrael. You have no claim to the land, because in the eyes of the goyim, you're a bunch of murderers and robbers. So you don't have a claim to Eretz Yisrael. You don't even need Eretz Yisrael. Because Eretz Yisrael, the whole purpose is to create a society where the values and standards are based on God. So in order to be able to keep any mitzvahs, before the first mitzvah starts, you're going to have the right values and standards and outlook and lifestyle. That's Bereshis Bara Elohim. Why? Because God put us in a tremendously difficult situation. If we base our moral standards, ethics on Him, then we're not murderers and we're not robbers. God gave these people life. He can tell us to take it away. It's the only reason that we're allowed to do it, because God told us to do it. Otherwise, we're just like Hitler. He killed men, women, and children. We killed men. Ethnic cleansing. What's the difference? One difference. God told us to do it. And God has the right to tell us because He gave these people life. And God didn't tell Hitler to do it. And if people claim that God told them, then in the end analysis, they're going to have to face up to the fact that God didn't really tell them. But God really told us. So if we base our value standards and ethics on God, then we are not murderers, we're not robbers, and we have a claim to Eretz Yisrael, and we need Eretz Yisrael, because this is the place where we can create a society that's based on that different lifestyle. But if we want to base our values and standards on the nations of the world, then we'll never be able to keep the Torah. Every mitzvah is going to be a conflict with our basic lifestyle, values, and standards. Rabbi Hollander saw once him quoted as saying, a gewaltige Wort, the more you think about it, it's really... He said, people who basically have a secular lifestyle, but they want to be firm. They want to keep tired mitzvahs. They don't have tired mitzvahs. They have 613 problems. Because every mitzvah is a problem. Every mitzvah is a conflict with their basic lifestyle. So it's a problem. But people whose lifestyle fits the Torah, then the mitzvahs are no problem at all. So if you make the Ribbono Shel Olam your standard, then you have a claim to Eretz Yisrael, and you need Eretz Yisrael, and you can keep mitzvahs. That's why it had to be the Hakdamah. The fact that Bereishis Bara Elokim, right, and the way that Eretz Yisrael was given to us, and that we need that answer, is not for them. It's korach ma'aseh higadli amo. It's for us. We need to know that we have a claim to Eretz Yisrael, and why we have a claim, and for what purpose we have a claim. And then you can start the Torah. If you don't understand that, then there's no Torah. You have a bunch of mitzvahs that are all going to be very difficult to keep because they're all going to be conflicting with your basic value standards and goals and lifestyle. So that is the basic purpose of Eretz Yisrael, to be able to create a society like that. How that happens, we will say for next week, and then we'll finish the mice of this part, this trilogy, and then we'll go on to other reasons, and we'll go back to also Hilchos Shabbos as part of the... Part of the...